Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I think anger comes from, as a woman, from invisibility, doesn't it? And that's why domestic roles make you feel angry, because they are disempowering, they are humiliating to a certain degree, they're without, you know, I was going to say status, but it's not really so much status that you're looking for, some kind of recognition of the amount of time, effort, hours that you put into it.
Welcome to Women Are Mad, where we invite women to bring their anger into everyday conversation. We're all feeling it. Let's get together to work out what to do with it. I'm Selima Saxton, I'm an actress and writer.
I'm Jennifer Cox, and I'm a psychotherapist. We noticed that anger is the one emotion that women aren't allowed to openly express. Meanwhile, everything around us is making us absolutely furious.
By talking about women's anger freely, we hope we'll inspire you to do the same.
Selima, what's made you mad this week?
Had a little bit of an argument with somebody. That is what made me mad. We've resolved it, which is great. But at the heart of this was really an idea about understatement. And actually, it's the use of understatement. I'm not going to go into the details of it because it's all resolved. And then I read this thing, this quote, and I'm just going to read it to you. So the Japanese emperor Hirohito, in August 1945, after Japan was, you know, defeated and everything, and obliterated like two cities, I think, with nuclear bombs, he broadcast that the war situation has developed not necessarily to Japan's advantage, which is obviously the most brilliant example of understatement. And it just made me reflect on how sometimes understating things can be a useful way to navigate situations. Are you going to completely disagree with me?
This is so interesting to me.
I'd like to know what you think.
Yeah, because I think like there's such a power in, for example, what he said. There's probably some phrase for it, isn't there? When you say the opposite, basically, and
yes,
and the what you actually mean therefore lands much more clearly. I think it's almost like case by case. Like if you were doing that all the time and you essentially were a sort of repressed, stick up the bum person, then I would say this is not doing your mind or body any good at all. But high drama all the time is very crying wolf and can
absolutely
lead to basically people kind of burning out with you and going, I've had too much of this, I can't take it anymore, you're on your own. So that's dangerous.
There's that whole quote about, you know, what is it, 95% of things or 98% of things never actually come true, you know, the things that you worry about.
Right? Yeah, that's Mark Twain or whoever said
that. Is that Mark Twain? Yes. Mm. And so, you know, if you take that and then combine
I love how it's
that,
all men, by the way, all these quotes.
I know. Sorry, I'm a bit better at this. Yeah. Holding something, acknowledging it, and then looking on the optimistic side or understating it slightly out loud might sometimes be helpful to move it through.
Yes. And do you know, I think it's something about giving the other person a choice. You're saying, you know what? I, who are delivering the news, I'm choosing to absorb a lot of the impact of this and hold it away from you.
Yes.
You then can decide where you fit with it, what you want to do.
Yeah.
Where, do you want to be in this with me?
What's your opinion, even? Rather than the end of the world is nigh.
And deciding that on your behalf. Well, that's cleared up.
Yeah.
I'm going to intro our guest. Our guest today is all about big, raw emotions, pain, loss, grief, joy, sorrow, and rage. She's consistently captured the smallness and largeness of life through her books, The Wild Other, to this year's The Giant on the Skyline. Please welcome the emotionally eloquent Clover Stroud.
Clover, we're just going to dive straight in and ask you, Clover, what makes you angry?
Oh, my God. Cooking supper? Cooking supper makes me really angry. The fact that it happens every single day, just relentlessly. And you cook something really nice sometimes, like a lasagna. You know, you really make an effort and think, oh, I've cooked supper. And then you have to fucking well do it again the next day.
Does it always land on you?
Yes, it always lands on me. And, you know, I'm really interested by kind of gender roles within marriages. And I'm very, very happy in my marriage and very committed in my marriage. And there are certain things that I always do, which I do want to kick back about, like cooking. But I do also think, I think it's Brené Brown says that a long-term marriage relationship, you know, is not 50-50, and it's unrealistic to think that it has to be 50-50 because life doesn't work like that. You know, it's more fluid
and shifts, doesn't it?
It shifts. And there's tons and tons and tons that he does, which I don't do. But the cooking supper makes me really, really mad, as they say in America.
So what aspect of it, if you had to kind of distill it down, what is the most, it's the repetitive nature that you have to do it again?
I resent a lot of things that we do on a daily basis, you know, like even from self-care of personal hygiene, sorry to say.
You talked about having to put deodorant on every single day. There's
something about me, there's a quiet rebellion in me always stirring, wanting to exit out of routine. Routines make me quite anxious and thinking of death, actually. Ooh. How are you with habits, Clover?
I think of myself as quite a disorganized person because I'm all over the place. I hate spreadsheets. I hate somebody saying, what are you doing next Tuesday at 3? Can you do this? Yeah. And yet I get a lot done. So I don't think I am I have a kind of disorganized chaos. That's what it is. I think it's a disorganized chaos. Because you cannot be like a massively disorganized person and like not, you know, get 5 kids to school on time and write books. And there is, even though there's in my house, there's mess everywhere. And I think people like me on Instagram because I'm reassuringly messy, basically. And I don't present a picture of perfection at all. So I suppose that I do have some routines within that chaos of like, here living in Washington, where I'm living now in America, I like taking my dog for a walk on the way back from dropping the kids at school. I have to have a cup of coffee, but that's more of a sort of drug thing, actually.
Ritual. Yeah. Different to kind of routine somehow.
Yes, agreed.
Yeah, yeah. I think routine, I get bored by things pretty quickly as well. And I like, I've had a career I've been freelance since I was 23. So when you're freelance, you never really have, your life is always, you know, every day is slightly different and you never know quite what's going to be, you know, you don't have a place where you always go for your sandwiches or whatever, those things that you might do if you were going to work in the same place.
So lots of people like routine, don't they? Because they feel as if there's predictability in a very unpredictable world. But for you, it sounds like it wouldn't be what you look to for stability.
No, I think what I look to for stability, I realise actually, is my work. So we moved to America in August last year and I had about, you know, the kids were off school for a month and then there was about 3 months where I really didn't know what was going on. It's very hard moving abroad. It's way harder than people think. You think it's just like one big holiday and it really isn't. And I didn't really know what was happening with my work. And once I figured my work out, what I'm writing next, where I go to write, the times that I create for doing my work, then I immediately felt better and everything else kind of fits around that. I find a day where I can't work really makes me feel depressed.
Yes.
We went on holiday last week and I found we were in California and I was getting up at 4 a.m. to work just so that I could get some work done before the kids got up, because that feeling of like having achieved something, having created something, having had some sane adult thoughts is really, really important to me, basically. Yeah.
We totally agree.
I don't even need to ask Jenny. That's how Jenny and I really operate. Part of the reason why we do this and have been friends for so many years.
Do you think as well, though, the writing for you is how you process, and even maybe without knowing it, it's your way of getting ahead of yourself on top of the day, like sorting things out emotionally?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I've had a lot of loss in my life, had a lot of tragedy and trauma. I've had a high degree of tragedy and trauma. And I think that writing is a way of, you know, I think I'm almost obsessional in my analysis of emotion. I analyze what I'm feeling, why I'm feeling, how that was different from how I was feeling before, what I might be feeling in the future, all the time. And I'm lucky enough to have kind of created a career where I can write about that and think about that literally the entire time. You know, I'm at the moment embarking on my fifth memoir, and they're all like extremely close analysis of what's going on in my head, reflected in my life. So writing is definitely, yeah, the way that I find kind of reassurance. And also, I love the beauty of words. And for me, writing beautiful books is really, really important. The kind of quality of the words that I'm writing and trying to express. The newest book that I've just written, called The Giant on the Skyline, which is out in May, is about home and leaving home and what homesickness is and what nostalgia is. And then that goes into like, well, what is memory? What is our relationship with time? What are we losing as we move on, you know, into, I'm 49 now, as our kids grow up? What is it that we want to take with us from the past? What do we want to leave behind from the past? So it's, you know, I'm trying to kind of analyze and understand quite complex emotions, actually trying to put words around complex emotions. And it's, yeah, I definitely find it hugely, hugely reassuring and hugely kind of, when I've communicated a quite complicated emotion, then I feel like I can not exactly move on from it, but I can kind of, you know, I understand it and I can think about another emotion.
And for you, Clover, where has anger entwined itself in your life? Interestingly, whenever so often when we have guests on, people start off, when we first ask them what makes them angry, with a very domestic answer or a very tangible, immediate thing. And I always find it intriguing where we then end up.
I think anger comes from kind of, well, I mean, it feels rather obvious to say this, but as a woman, from invisibility, doesn't it? And that's why domestic roles make you feel angry, because they are disempowering. They are humiliating to a certain degree. They're without, you know, I was going to say status, but it's not really so much status that you're looking for. It's some kind of recognition of the amount of time, effort, hours that you put into it. And I was explaining to my husband, like he does loads of work around for us as a family around booking our holidays, which is loads of work and it takes loads of research, and especially living abroad, it's more complicated. And when he does that, then I'm very grateful for that. But there is a kind of hero status to it, in that you've booked the holiday and how wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yes.
God, that's so great. And it's going to be so much fun. And we look forward to it. And then we talk about it afterwards. Nobody in my entire adult life has ever once said to me, thank you so much for lying on your stomach on the floor and pulling my dirty clothes from underneath the bed, turning them the right way around, taking them downstairs, putting them in the washing machine, and drying them, then folding them up and then putting them in the drawers. That's just so kind of you. Like, nobody has once ever said that.
And the point as well, I think, about like layers and levels of invisibility. So for example, when you said about the lasagna, there it is. It's plonked out in front of people. They have no idea of the intricacies at each stage of preparation that have gone into that. They just see this big fat meal. There it is. They don't think about, you know, what process. Whereas a holiday, every stage of it is visible.
Ta-da.
Ta-da!
Yeah.
Your passport is in your hand. You're at an airport. Everyone on the step of that journey is going, well done for booking your holiday. Come through. Come and sit in this seat of the plane. Well done for booking your holiday. It's so public.
No, definitely. As you say, that the thing of getting the food into the house and making sure you've got the can of tomatoes that you need to make the lasagna, and that you make the mince, then you haven't got the... And it sounds really overprivileged, because I'm also aware that by having this conversation, we are lucky that we have a shop to go to buy the, and the wherewithal to buy the food and so on. And I'm very aware of the kind of sounding spoiled by complaining about making the lasagna again. And yet, you know, me and my husband are of the same, he has absolute respect for me, and we are of the same status within our relationship. And yet the kind of low status work goes, is often something that the woman has to do. The person who has been, you know, and I made choices about this as well. I made choices that I created a career that I wanted to be around for my kids. I wanted to be a writer. One of the reasons I wanted to be a writer is because it works, you know, quite well with mm-hmm. fitting around children. But then those choices have further sort of ramifications, which you are not kind of aware of, I suppose.
Husbands don't generally make those choices, do they?
No. No, and also if it said like, okay, well, I'll... You know, right at the beginning, there was no question of me not wanting to be at home with the baby. Yeah. But with the baby, there was that, you know, if he had said, right, I'm going to take a year off and you can work full time, I wouldn't have accepted that at all. Mm. And therefore, you know, it's kind of, it has been my choice, and I do want to be the one around for the kids, but it's complicated and it makes you angry. It is a sort of PA type of role.
Yes.
Lot, isn't it?
Yes.
Enabling to have independence, yeah. To be there for them, but not in their face, and yes. Organizing them to be able to go out safely and feel independent. No, it is a lot of, that's what I'm finding actually at the moment with my younger three, the kind of logistics side of it is demanding. It's very demanding, definitely.
Yes. But, and again, I suppose that does fall primarily to the woman partner is straddling that delicate tightrope of too much, too little, claustro-aggro, you know, what can a kid tolerate? What do they need? I don't think a lot of that thinking is being done primarily by men.
Clover, since we started doing this, I have really shifted in my viewpoints, because basically at the beginning of this, Jen would say things like that, and I would say, no, we cannot speak about men in this way. I kept saying, no, but we can't generalize. I'm sure there are, you know, we can't say this.
I called her an instrument of the patriarchy.
Yeah.
Over.
Yes. And you know, at my grand old age, I'm slowly coming out of this, what is it? People pleasing. Yes, Jenny, instrument of the patriarchy.
Well, for fear. I think terror of men.
Yes. Of, yeah, do you think?
I mean, yes.
I'm settling into, yeah, okay, it is primarily women this happens to. But I've been so hesitant to use the language that Jenny has always been really comfortable using. Mm. Where do you sit with that kind of language?
I mean, my eldest child is 23. My kids are 23, 20, 11, 10, and 7. I always have to concentrate to remember how old they all are. So having spent a lot of time in the playground at the school gate, it's women who are doing... I mean, yes, of course there are exceptions. Of course there are exceptions. But predominantly in an urban playground in England, in a rural playground in England, in an urban playground in a major city, I'm in Washington, D.C., it is women who make up the people standing waiting at the school gate for the vast majority. And whether that is a granny, a nanny, an au pair, a mother, a childminder, it's women. And so I don't mind generalizing, because we're doing, that's what we're doing. And if I say on my Instagram, this on Instagram, occasionally one man will say, no, look, like count me as well. But There's just like a roar of recognition from women.
Yes.
I think we're desperate for that, you know. I think it's something about, like, maybe our mother's generation, it was still such a given. Like, if they had work, it was really fitted around the school day and holidays and all of that. You know, so it was part-time, probably quite care-based work anyway, teaching, nursing, all of that. I'm, again, generalising, but for the largest part, I would say. And then we're here and it's all meant to be so different, but it's not different. And I think that's the roar of recognition.
And I think it's really difficult because I don't think that wraparound childcare is the answer to all of this as well. I do believe that children, not all the time, but they do need a kind of primary caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that that is really healthy for children. And so somebody has got to make some kind of sacrifices along the way. And I don't think that, you know, when you see kids going off to nursery really early in the morning and staying there until, I know a child who goes to nursery for their three meals a day. And I just think that that's,
and in the States, they're doing that from like a month old.
Really young.
Obviously, sometimes people don't have that choice. I accept that.
But yeah, no, I also accept that.
Yeah, but I agree with you about the word sacrifice as well. And I wish that in our generation anyway, maybe it has shifted in the younger generations, that we'd spoken more about that. Jen and I met, you know, when we were 18, you know, we had all these grand plans, but in all our grand plan planning, we never spoke about the impact of potential motherhood. Mm-hmm. And for example, I was able to choose to be very present and at home with my kids and didn't go to, I'm an actor, didn't audition for many years, things like that. But I kind of felt sheepish about that for a long time. And people go, oh, come on, you've got to get back into it.
I don't think we talk enough. Like, this is a conversation that I'm keen to be having anyway, is, so I'm like massively pro basically attachment parenting, you know, slapping the baby onto you, feeding whenever they want, sleeping with you. Like, that is best.
That's
for
how
baby.
I did. That's what I did.
And that's what we know.
Without using it without understanding that that's what
I
was doing. Yeah.
Mm. But instinctively, but also scientifically, this is best for baby. But my kind of project now is, what is best for women? And how do we square the two? And how do we have this really complex, really, really important conversation about allowing that next generation what they need, but also not kind of killing ourselves in the process?
Yeah. It's really, really complicated. I mean, my feeling at the moment, so I had my first child at 23, and then I had two children in my early mid-20s, two children in my mid-late 30s and one in my 40s. And people don't really like hearing this, but I am a really massive believer in having your children as young as possible, because I think that it is less complicated and you are better equipped, maybe not financially, but I genuinely believe that you are better equipped emotionally and 100% better equipped physically. And people don't want to hear this, but you are... It has been so tiring and so deranging having children in my late 30s and 40s. In my early 20s, when my life was very, very insecure, I had absolutely no help. I was in a very, very complicated marriage, married to an addict. I had no support. I had no money. That bit of parenting was much easier than the parenting that I have done in my 30s, married to somebody that I absolutely love, both of us earning money, so-called, you know, financially stable-ish. We have income and so on. We know what we're doing. It's so much harder on so many levels. And I think I was probably a better mother. I mean, I'm a good mother. I'm proud of being a good mother. I'm really, really engaged with my kids. But I sometimes think I was a better mother in my 20s when it was chaos and I was just bumbling through. And your life, you know, for most people, your life in your 20s is pretty chaotic. And I made sacrifices and I made decisions about, you know, living in a place where there was cheaper housing, for example, in order to be able to have that baby in my 20s. And I, you know, I say to my kids now, like, don't hang around. If you meet somebody who you like, don't hang around and don't think that that you're going to get to a place in your future where you are a more financially stable, better equipped to have a baby. And I look at people who've had kids in their 20s. And the thing that happens is that, you know, very few relationships last from their 20s. But because you're so young and it's such a long time to expect to still be together in your 40s, 50s, 60s. I have not one single regret, not a single moment. I am so grateful that when I got pregnant at 23, I feel almost tearful talking about it. I am so relieved that I had that baby, even though I was in a complete chaos and like it was scary. It was totally scary.
I love how you use the word chaos and how many times you use the word chaos, actually. You kind of you're helping me reclaim it.
We don't feel frustrated if we allow chaos to reign. Because, you know, so if you're thinking about what causes anger, a lot of it is attempting to control things that we can't control.
I know. And there's what's happening on social media at the moment. And this idea that cleanliness, tidiness, order, meal planning, marry condoing, you know, perfect houses. And there's this real trend at the moment for people showing how they're planning their meals and doing it all in boxes. God. It's like, this is mad. Why am I watching this for a start? Why am I watching this person like filling all their bottles up with smoothies that they've made and putting all identical food in the fridge?
But this is this trad wife thing almost, or a kind of fetishization of domesticity, I think.
Clover. Back to your anger. When do you feel it? What does it look like?
Well, I've been trying to feel it and not become it. I've just gone on to Substack recently. I wrote about this, about feel it and don't become it. Because I started finding that I don't remember getting that angry in my 20s, even though it was utter chaos. I think in my 30s, I got quite depressed. I think my anger took a depression. I got very bad postnatal depression with my third and fourth child because I felt overwhelmed, I think, and multiple different things, which are complex. But in my 40s, I got angry and I started smashing cups, ripping lamps from walls, and kicking chest of drawers in. Really, I got really, really angry with... And this was about 3 years ago when I suddenly, I wasn't doing that all the time, but I broke several of my favorite mugs. And I do remember like picking up a lamp and ripping it out of the wall and standing in the kitchen. I had lots of drawers in my last kitchen and just standing up and like kicking the drawer shut. So I was so angry with domestic life and the frustration of all the things we've been talking about, trying to work and having to instead, you know, not being able to work, not being able to express myself, not being able to earn money in the way that I wanted to do because the domestic roles were overwhelming me. And I think that was the circumstances of my life of doing a lot of parenting on my own. My husband was away for long periods of time, and that's why eventually we moved to America. And also, you know, maybe a hormonal thing as well. But I think it was when I talked to a doctor about what was happening in my life, they said it's the circumstances of your life. It's not so much what your body's doing. But I did start taking...
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I didn't want to do HRT because I've got a lot of cancer in my family and I'm nervous about the associations around that, whatever the research is saying. And so I started taking a herbal supplement, and I found that has helped me and I feel less angry. So that for a while, my anger was quite unpleasant and quite scary, and it's not nice. And I was becoming the anger rather than just feeling it. And I feel as though I'm getting better at no longer smashing all the mugs, for sure.
What do you do with it instead?
I write about it sometimes. Mm. I started lifting weights, which sometimes I found that's quite good way, maybe. I do it sporadically. I'd like to say I do it every morning. I don't. But I think that just going and doing something, which is physically kind of satisfying for yourself, slogging around. You know, I've been trying to jog, but sometimes I just feel so gross when I'm jogging that doing some weights is quite satisfying. Yes, but I think that I write about it, and sometimes I just seethe as well. Yes. You know, go for a walk and seethe, and walk around and go, for fuck's sake, walking around, and then, you know, try and come home and let it go, because I think also the knowledge that everything passes is really, really important. You know, the anger will pass, and the people that I'm angry with, which is usually my family, are all actually just trying their best as well and dealing with a lot of their own stuff.
But getting it out the house, I think, is really good, because it passes, but it passes faster if you take it out of that setting and you process by walking.
Yeah,
because that's really great bilaterally. And then when you come back, things feel different.
I agree with you. And I found it interesting. So I lived in a landscape that I absolutely loved in Oxfordshire, which was big and expansive and big skies. And making the decision to leave there to move to this city was really hard. And that's kind of what my book is about, The Giant on the Skyline. But now I don't, where we live, I can walk long distances. And actually Washington is a city with wide pavements and wide vistas. It's not like Manhattan or something like that. It's and I find that when I go and walk down these wide pavements and wide streets, and you get quite a big view of the sky, I actually do find it very calming. The worst thing to do is to stay in the house surrounded by the mess, and that is an absolute recipe for depression, rage, resentment, fury.
Yeah. And the electronics and going into some kind of like doom scrolling hole.
Yeah.
Which is what I do if I'm feeling weak.
Yeah. Get out.
Get out. Any walk anywhere, or if I've got to work, take myself to a public library, take myself to a cafe, although I can find a cafe because it's a bit too busy for writing, but kind of go into a public space away from home. And because home is a lovely place, I don't want to turn it into a place of rage, you know.
I also think just being near other humans whose stories you don't fully know or know at all can be very helpful for a reset. You know, just reminding you that you're part of all of this. Like, that's why I like being near the trees, even, or whatever. And just know they've been around and they will be around when I'm long gone. I like feeling quite small as part of something much, much bigger than myself. Makes me feel quite reassured.
Yes. In fact, the landscape that I lived in England is ancient, and it's kind of near Avebury standing stones, and it's full of, you know, there's a Neolithic chalk horse where we live and hill forts. And I find that sense that people were there 4,500 years ago doing this stuff. That is, you know, realizing and remembering the insignificance of yourself in a positive way is a really, really, really good thing. I'm really trying. I'm 49. A lot of people that I love have died. My sister, my older sister, who's 46, died when I was 44. I'm really, really trying to enjoy this life. This life is short, and I'm going to be dead soon, and that is an absolute certainty. And I am really trying to kind of put myself further in, deeper into the days. And yes, I absolutely get angry, and I get furious, and I get depressed, anxiety. I have all of those things, and I've been through periods of really bad, you know, really, really, that's been really bad. But life is also like astonishingly beautiful, and I'm trying to feel that amongst the rage and chaos and frustration of it as well.
I love talking to Clover. I find her using the word chaos so soothing, actually. It just reminds me that if I want to cram all of these things in to this chaotic life of mine, then it's not going to just be lasagna every
there won't evening. Be many lasagnas.
No, and that's okay. That's fine. But I just, you know what this about me. It's taken me a long time to realize that
this whole kind of having it all idea, that is quite at the root of it. This point you have to achieve everything and make, you know, your children, home, work, life, absolutely, you know, on the money. But you also have to look fantastic. And as if none of it is an effort. No wonder we're all fucking raging.
Indeed.
Thank you for listening and sharing in our anger.
And remember, you're not mad to feel mad.
Please like and subscribe. It helps other people find the podcast.